Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol.
It was a total pleasure to meet Dr. David McCartney in his home in the Scottish Borders for this, and I hope you will quickly see why he has so much to offer us from both his professional and personal experiences. In part one, Dr. McCartney explains the model of therapeutic community treatment used at Lothian's inpatient residential rehab programme that he ran for 17 years. We discuss the neuroscience of addiction, the difficulty of early recovery especially, the concept of recovery capital, and the power of mutual aid.
I'm really happy that you've taken the time, thank you, to have this chat. I first met you, David McCartney, at the Alcohol Study Day, where you presented on the brain physiology of addiction, and I found that really useful and have used quite a few of those things with my patients over the years since then. But maybe you could introduce yourself a little bit.
Well, my name's David McCartney. I'm a GP by training. I spent the first half of my career in inner city GP practice in Glasgow, and then the latter half of my career working in addictions in Lothian. What else do I do? I do a little bit of work with the Scottish Government on drug policy, and until very recently I was working with NHS Healthcare Improvement Scotland, helping support the inspection of independent healthcare facilities where addiction was part of the treatment.
And am I right in thinking that you used to run LEAP, the inpatient rehab that we have in Lothian?
That's right, yeah. I was the clinical lead at LEAP for about 17 years. And in fact, started it off at the beginning. Yeah, that was a big part of my career.
And this podcast, we hope to reach sort of GPs and practice nurses throughout Scotland. But so for folk who might not know NHS Lothian, could you tell us a little bit about what LEAP is and are there equivalents throughout the country?
Yeah, no, LEAP is pretty unique in that it's a rehab, a residential rehab, or more accurately, a quasi-residential rehab, which means the accommodation is on different sites from where the treatment is delivered. So it is pretty unique in the NHS because generally, if you want to go to rehab, you have to go to a third sector provider or a private provider. And the concept behind LEAP was that people, if they need rehab, should have access to it on the same basis that they have access to treatment for heart disease or diabetes or any other common condition. That should be free at the point of delivery to a high standard of care and integrated with other parts of the health service.
If you could just describe what happens in LEAP. And
the treatment model is called therapeutic community. And in a therapeutic community, which is a long-established model of delivery for residential rehab, in a therapeutic community, the patients themselves become part of the treatment process, and community becomes a catalyst for getting better. So the idea is that the new people coming in are mentored by people who've been there for a bit longer. They're looked after, they're helped through their detox, they're supported, they're challenged as well. So they're challenged on their thinking and their behaviour. As people move through the programme, their thinking gets a bit clearer. They begin to understand some of the behaviour patterns that have been tripping them up in the past, and they're able to identify those patterns in other people. And in a caring way, they're able to help identify those and to bring them to the attention of others. That's done in a variety of ways, living together, being in group therapy sessions together, and having specific pieces of psychological therapy work to do helps bring all these things to the surface. It's quite difficult to explain because it's complex, and as well as that's the core of the model. As well as that, there's all of the medical side of it going on as well. So we do we had at LEAP, I'm no longer there, but we had a psychiatrist, we had an OT, we had nurses and doctors, we had access to all the usual NHS facilities, physio and dentistry and so on. So the idea was we had a holistic model from referral through pre-care to treatment itself to aftercare. We were trying to identify unmet needs and to get all of those needs met or started to be met by the time people came to the end of treatment. And aftercare itself was for another 2 years. Right. So the understanding is that addiction dependence on substances, alcohol and other substances, is a chronic thing. It doesn't necessarily just go away. There's a tendency towards returning to drinking unless the supports are really robust. So that's why there's a really robust aftercare process in place.
Do you join it with the same group of people from the start to finish?
No, it's a rolling program. So it wouldn't work. It works on the basis of the people who become more experienced, more aware, more self-aware, almost awakening a kind of altruistic thing inside as well that wants to support new people coming in.
Yeah.
That as you progress through treatment, you gain what we call recovery capital. Yeah. And that's part of it. And that recovery capital can be passed on to other people. I mean, it's some of the stuff I'm talking about, it's not really easy to study in a scientific way, because we're talking about the delivery or the communication, the transmission of hope. Seeing people who are further on than you, getting a sort of fire in your belly from that, thinking, gosh, if they can do it, maybe I can do it. And that gives momentum, and then the people that have got that momentum and energy can start to pass it on to the new people coming in. I say I'm trying to describe it, but it's much easier to see when you visit and you become aware of what happens in the therapeutic community.
I am actually imagining it. I don't know if this is a romanticized imagination I have, but I don't know if you've ever read Marion Keyes' Rachel's Holiday.
Yes, I have. Yes, it's very like that.
You talk, that's how I'm imagining it, and it seems to me like that's the character Rachel in this couple of novels now goes through this kind of rolling program, and I can sort of see how you begin to identify patterns in other people which help you recognize it in yourself. Yeah,
that's a really nice, I mean, it's a humorous and quite light way of looking at it.
Yeah,
I think it captures some of the challenges as well. There are lots of challenges to the model. You're bringing in people from a variety of different backgrounds, a variety of different stages, with a variety of different experiences, and most people, yeah, the majority will have a history of trauma. People might have behavioural difficulties, mental health difficulties. A lot of people with alcohol problems have got physical health impairments. You're bringing them together. They don't necessarily, on paper, look like they're going to fit together and work together. And yet somehow in this milieu of people, connections begin to develop. Sometimes what seems very unlikely connections, people from different backgrounds. And something amazing begins to happen. So, I mean, therapeutic communities have been studied, and there's an understanding of the mechanisms by which this works. It's not just about people connecting to each other. It's also about us helping people to connect to wider supports in the community. So a big part of the thrust of action when people are in treatment, it's getting them connected up to recovery supports in the community, so mutual aid groups, groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and Smart Recovery. But also there are other recovery resources out there where people can form new sober networks, so pro-recovery networks, because a lot of people coming into treatment are coming from networks where it's pro-drinking. Their friends and their buddies and so on are on a culture of drinking, or if it's drug use. And you really need to change those relationships if you want to stay sober going forward. And that's quite a difficult process, letting go of old associations and finding new ones.
Huge, actually, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it can be facilitated. There are ways to do that.
Yeah.
And so patients, when they're with LEAP, will be expected to attend mutual aid meetings and become part of the recovery community in Lothian.
Yeah.
And then when they leave treatment, although LEAP itself continues to provide aftercare in a kind of formal, structured way, our patients were encouraged to become part of local recovery networks and supports.
And what does the aftercare look like? Do people who've been in I don't want to say inpatient, I don't know, do you call it inpatient or in as a resident in LEAP, do they then come back for like weekly sessions or...
Yeah. I left clinical practice last year, so I'm not there any longer, but as far as I'm aware, it's still the same. There are maybe five or six or perhaps more aftercare sessions across the week.
Okay.
Some of them in Mid Lothian and West Lothian, so that there's local aftercare to go to rather than having to come into Edinburgh City. Some of those, most of them are structured, they're facilitated by a professional. And people will come along, really talk essentially about what's going on for them, because it's very, very challenging. Early recoveries are a challenging time.
Mm.
And they talk about what's going on for them, and they get the support of the group.
Yeah.
And the group have become their friends because they've been either been in treatment with them or they've gotten to know them through aftercare. And that's a really supportive process. Probably the bigger part of it is the development of those relationships outside of the formal treatment setting which become the sort of underpinning elements for ongoing recovery. And if people relapse, which happens in early recovery, there's a variety of different options which are available. They can be brought back into treatment for a short program, so kind of like a booster, if you like, support. So if they need a detox, they can have that again, and then get them restructured into these supportive networks.
I mean, I'm sure lots of people will have this too, but I often have patients come in and they've made the decision that's enough is enough. They want something to change and they want inpatient detox now. And, you know, they want immediate admission to something like LEAP. And what I've sort of picked up from attending your talks and other things is to try and explain that actually engaging first with, for example, in our area would be Turning Point, and sort of building up to it is helpful in understanding that if, you know, you're in this bubble for 3 months, is it? And but then, you know, what happens afterwards is really key. And so if you can sort of build your networks and build your recovery capital before and after, it's going to make it
yes.
more successful. So I've really taken that from what you said. The other thing that I really use a lot with patients from one of your talks is this idea that when alcohol has dominated your dopamine reward system in your brain for so long, and then you come off alcohol, small things like going for coffee or meeting with people or cinema aren't necessarily going to bring you much pleasure because they're not alcohol. And being warned about that sort of lack of pleasure in early recovery is important.
When I was at LEAP, I did two talks to patients. There's a little bit of kind of didactic teaching for patients when they're in treatment, and one of those was about the neuroscience of addiction. So we did try to explain in an accessible format that very thing you've just talked about. So the continuous release of large amounts of dopamine results in a down-regulation of dopamine receptors. In other words, there are fewer receptors to pick up the feel-good chemical, the rewards chemical, and that means in early recovery, when people have stopped drinking, it can take quite some time for those levels of dopamine receptors to return to normal.
Mm.
And we think that translates into anhedonia or a lack of capacity to feel normal pleasure.
Mm.
So the first part of recovery can be a bit greyed out and a bit of a challenge. I've had patients say to me, not infrequently, you know, is this what recovery feels like? Because I'm not liking it very much. And it's really about trying to get them through that difficult patch.
Yeah.
One of the nice things that happens in treatment is people begin to laugh again. Even in those early few months, you can begin to hear, partly because of hope, we've got hope again, but also because of the restoration beginning to happen of normal brain physiology and biochemistry that people begin to pick up. And that's another advantage of trying to keep them in community, keep them connected to other people, because it's very easy to become isolated and without that stimulation and support get flat again. But yeah, you're right, it's difficult. Early recovery is difficult, and it's variable. Some people pick up much more quickly than others, but most people will struggle to start with.
I'm sort of seeing our job as GPs and nurses to maybe even explain recovery capital to our patients and help them build their own recovery capital, but it would be kind of helpful to just know exactly what you mean by that, maybe a few examples.
Recovery capital it relates to the resources that people can draw on to get well again, to resolve the problems that resulted from their alcohol dependence. So these can be internal and external resources. Really, recovery capital can be built. We can do something to improve it. Attending to internal wounds is important, but also there's a variety of things like family connections. I mean, one of the things that LEAP does is run a family program, because we are aware that the family is also damaged when there's alcohol dependence in a household or in a family unit. So attending to the needs of families increases recovery capital, because the families begin to look after their own needs and begin to tend to themselves and get better from the whole dysfunction that goes around dependence. Building recovery capital involves supporting families. It can involve things like education, training and employment. So LEAP has a third sector organisation that works there, which helps build skills during treatment. They come down and do a component every week, but also gives them a bridge to going on to do some education and employment opportunities when they leave LEAP. So most people finishing LEAP will go on to do this program from the third sector organisation. And then there is community recovery capital. So that's what I was talking about earlier, connecting people up to mutual aid groups. Lothian and the whole of Scotland actually has a rich resource in mutual aid, which are independent groups, independent of treatment, which are meeting. There's about 1,000 of them, I think, meeting every week in Scotland.
Wow.
And those groups, there's really strong evidence now that connecting people into mutual aid groups gives much better outcomes. And when you add mutual aid into treatment, it's got a cumulative effect. So we should be doing our best to get people connected into those, not just mutual aid, but recovery community resources. And the best way to find out about those, if you are a GP or nurse listening to this, would be just to go onto the Alcohol and Drug Partnership website, ADP website, for the area you're in, and they will list the resources that are available within the area you're in.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I really took away from the alcohol study day, is just the paramount importance of mutual aid, far more than drugs and anything else, and also just that how much exists without me realising. You know, I learnt that in Edinburgh there's a recovery community cafe, and there's an activity organised every single day of the year, including Christmas Day, for folk in recovery, and that was just completely eye-opening to me. I didn't know that. Group therapy I find very hard to sell to patients, but having experienced it in a peer support group, I can now really understand that complex process that happens when you start to see other people recognise patterns and make connections. That makes total sense to me, actually. And, you know, I mentioned in my first question about this must be quite resource heavy. Obviously, ultimately, I'm sure it saves a lot of resources, you know, because if we can get people into recovery, that's going to save resources. But how have you found getting the resources that you need for something?
If I go back to the beginning, you know, sourcing the funding to start the project off, actually, it was a lining up of the planets. I pitched my idea for the project to the head of the equivalent of the Alcohol and Drug Partnership at the time. He pitched it to the Scottish Government, who had some unspent money as it was coming towards the end of the year, and they had to spend it because they couldn't carry it forward.
So it was a good time to pitch.
And at the time, they were getting the government was getting hammered in the press for this was not around alcohol, but around drug treatments, and they were, you know, essentially there was one game in town if you had a drug problem, and that was methadone, which is a very effective treatment, but people who wanted to move on from methadone didn't have a lot of choices. Mm-hmm. In fact, you really had very little chance of getting into detox or rehab. So the government were in a very sort of open frame of mind with regard to projects that were hoping to add something else into the treatment spectrum, mm-hmm. and they funded some pilot projects, and LEAP was one of those projects.
So roughly was that? Are we talking?
I pitched the idea in 2006, and the funding came, I think, later that year, and we launched in 2007.
Okay.
There was 2 years funding, and we didn't have quite enough to do what I wanted to do, so I went to some grant giving bodies and got some extra money for that to add in, which is a bit difficult because the grant giving bodies don't normally give to the NHS, but we managed to get some funding, and that allowed us to launch the programme proper. And then at the end of the 2 years, we put in place an evaluation, which then turned into a study, which had very rigorous outcome measures, and we were able to evidence very quickly that we were having a very significant impact on people's journeys and outcomes. They were able to retain significant numbers of people all the way through, and the people that stayed all the way through had a very good chance of staying abstinent when they left. left. We learned as we went along as well. We learned what worked and what didn't work, and we adjusted the program because we had quality improvement measures in place to understand that and to learn. When we came to the end of the 2 years, the government was putting more money into the treatment system for alcohol treatment. The local alcohol and drug partnerships said, okay, this seems to be working, we like your data, we will continue to fund what the government were funding, and that was great. The problem has been, whenever the health services got squeezed, like it is at the moment, the powers that be tend to look for the lowest hanging fruit. So if you're in a system where you've got people stacked up in hospital wards who can't be discharged because there's nowhere to send them home to, and your care of the elderly services are creaking, and your mental health services are bursting, addiction services seem to be the one that get picked off. I think there's an institutional stigma going on there that sees addiction as less worthy than these other things.
Like these people have made life choices that have resulted in this.
I don't think
issue.
You'd hear anyone articulating that now.
Okay.
But there is, from my experience of working in the health service in addiction treatment, compared to working in general practice, which got squeezed as well, as we know, there is no doubt that addiction lies at the bottom of the hierarchy of what's important to big bosses. So that's not universal, perhaps, but it's essentially what happens. So over the years, there have been times when we have been asked to justify our existence, where we've been told that we are in scope for either getting closed down or having the funding reduced significantly. Fortunately, we've always had this really good outcome data to fall back on and say, actually, you know, we've got evidence that we are saving money in lots of different ways, and that we're making a difference. And unfortunately, a lot of services that are being funded don't have that evidence.
Yeah.
So it becomes a good argument to make when they're looking at 3 or 4 services for chopping.
Yeah.
And we can say, actually, we've got outcome data to 4 years, which is really detailed and very, very powerful.
I imagine it's quite hard to prove the cost saved, because how do you prove what hasn't happened as a result of your intervention?
Absolutely.
Do you extrapolate?
Yes, you can. So we measured physical health outcomes, we measured mental health outcomes, and we measured criminal justice outcomes, just to look at things that save money.
Yeah.
When I talked to my patients when I was in LEAP, you know, we'd have 28 maybe patients in listening to my talk on the brain science, and I'd always pause in the middle of it and say, how many of you have been to accident emergency in the last 18 months? And about 2/3 of them put their hands up. And if I went to the our aftercare group and asked them, how many of you have been to any in the last 18 months? Almost none of them would put their hands up.
Amazing,
you know? So you've got our patients with alcohol and other drug problems are very frequent users of the health service, and it's unscheduled care that they're having detoxes in acute hospital settings, which are just, it's a terrible way to manage a detox, is unscheduled in a crazily busy ward. There's much better ways to deal with that. So if we can evidence that actually we're stopping some of these people getting there, the problem is it doesn't really save money that you can then say, you know, the hospital department is still bulging at the seams and busy, you know. They don't say, oh, hang on a minute, you've saved £100 here, you can have it, you've saved £1,000 over here, you can have that. It's theoretical money that you're saving, so you still have to find a resource. And I've been really vocal in speaking up for our patients and resisting calls for efficiency savings and cutting funding. Fortunately, all up until the time I left, that was a successful. It was difficult, but we managed to make sure patients were protected.
One issue that we have as GPs is we tend to see people who are in crisis and who have problems, and the folk who've maybe been through LEAP 3 or 4 times and are still drinking. We're not really seeing the success stories. And I wondered if you could maybe tell us a little bit about some of the successes of LEAP, which we might not see from our end.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this is a well-recognised phenomenon that the people who do well from treatment move out of treatment settings. Even in general practice, they stop being frequent attenders, they stop being going to A&E. And you don't see them, but you do see the ones that are kind of cycling back and forwards. So that can lead to a real loss of hope and enthusiasm, or
a feeling of futility sometimes.
Defeated. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So it's well recognised that there was a nice piece of work that a British researcher did in Wales he asked people who were working with individuals who had drug problems in the community, how many of your clients do you think will ever recover from addiction? And the Welsh workers, I'm not singling out Wales as being any different from anywhere else, that's just where the research was done.
Sure.
They reckoned about 7% of the people they're working with would ever recover. But when you look at long-term treatment outcome studies, and actually studies that don't involve treatment at all, that are called natural recovery, people that don't need to come anywhere near treatment services, the recovery rate is much, much higher. So for treatment studies, it's 60% plus of people will resolve their problems in the long term.
Wow.
And for natural recovery, it goes up to nearly 90%. So what actually happens in reality is very different. These guys in Wales had a very low level of hope for the people they're working with, and it's understandable because they're working with the people that have got the highest problems, who are not moving out of treatment.
A skewed perspective.
Absolutely, and I think all of us who work in healthcare can have that skewed perspective, and it can lead to stigma because you begin to absorb some of that lack of ambition for the people we're working with. And once the treatment professional has a lack of ambition, the chances of the individual getting better become less. We've got lots of evidence of, I suppose at this point maybe it's a good idea just to talk about my own experience. We've got lots of examples at Leap of people who get well, who've come back to do volunteering with the service, who've then gone to do training and become professionals, worked in treatment, and that's the same across Scotland. There are lots of people working in drug and alcohol treatment services who have lived experience. You just need to come to the aftercare group at Leap on a busy day. Maybe there's 30 people there, and remember there's people coming every day across the week, but there are 30 people there in recovery. Some of them have been in recovery for more than 2 years. And they are doing well. You see the evidence. Mm. So in my position, it was really easy to believe people get better because I see the evidence of it all the time. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed learning from Dr. McCartney as much as I did. For those of you struggling with dependence yourselves, a reminder that he mentioned both the Sick Doctors Trust and the British Doctors and Dentists Group. And for all of us who need to be able to signpost our patients to mutual aid groups with conviction, our local alcohol and drug partnership website should be a good resource for what's available in our area.
Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.